you for reading. This is a workshop speaker meeting on the topic of growing up in NA, or growing up in recovery. And we have asked Kate to speak. I would like to introduce our first speaker, Kate.
I'm Kate, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Kate.
I've never shared at a convention before, so this is new and exciting. When I was asked to speak at this meeting, lots of things started going through my head because growing up in recovery can mean a couple things to a couple people. So for me, it's a two-ply of me physically and emotionally and spiritually growing up in recovery, but also my father is also an addict. And he's a big part of how and why I got to recovery. My parents were together. They split when I was 9. My dad was an addict. All the things, sex, drugs, rock and roll, gambling. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom. She started her own cleaning business and saved up enough money to leave him secretly. Because when you're married to a gambling addict, all the money goes out the window. Well, you know where it goes, down the drain, out the window, up his nose, all the places. And so she did what she had to do to protect her children. I have two blood older brothers, and she figured it out. When I was 9, she packed up the whole house and moved us while my dad was away. And when my dad came home, there was nothing. I mean, nothing. My mother is ruthless, and she took the light bulbs out of the light fixtures, which, like, I can laugh about now, because I'm very grateful that my mother's ruthless, because I got a little bit of that, and if used for good, it's okay, but when used and weaponized, it's not. But I had no idea that my dad was an addict, you know, like, him drinking beer was normal. Like, if I got hurt, he always had a cold beverage in his hand, and I could put it on whatever ailment was hurt. I remember asking him for sips of his beer, and he always said yes. So I liked the taste of beer from, like, a young age. Strange. And I thought it was normal. I thought it was normal that your dad likes to drink his beer. But I never realized, like, how in-depth it was. So when my mom packed all of the things up in the house and we moved, and my mom said that we were, you know, my parents were separating, my dad had no choice. If he wanted to see us again, he had to get it together. So he did. He started to go to the other fellowship. Got 1 year clean and went out on that 1 year anniversary to show my mom, and he got high. Thankfully, he did make his way back, and he celebrated 22 years clean this year. So I remember every other weekend, my dad would take me to a Saturday night meeting with him that he started with the flavor of the week that he had at the time. And she was a very nice lady. If I could ever find her again, I absolutely owe her an amends, because I did everything in my power as a 13-year-old little girl that I was to make sure that she didn't last. And shocker, she didn't, but she also started drinking again. And I know that that's not my shit because I was a child, but I knew what I was doing. I did. I didn't think I was going to make her drink, but, like, I knew I was trying to get her up out of that house. I was successful. But again, that ruthlessness that I weaponized. So I grew up knowing the Serenity Prayer. I used to make the joke, which the joke's on me, but I used to make the joke that I would say, now, obviously, it's not a joke. But I would say, when I have a problem, I'll know where to go. But the joke was on me, because I developed a problem very quickly. It started at a young age, sex, drugs, rock and roll, boys, purses, shoes, whatever. I still have an issue with shoes. My husband's in the room, and he can attest to it. They always fit. No matter how much weight I gain or lose, my shoes always fit, so that's a me problem. Okay, so I will co-sign the shit out of that. And they make me feel good, but whatever. How many pairs of black boots can one girl have? Probably 12, but whatever. That's a separate meeting for a separate day. So, my addiction was interesting. I was better than you people because I never put a needle in my arm. I just liked the smell of cocaine. But I didn't think I had a problem because I wasn't that bad. And, you know, I had a serious life-altering moment happen, and it brought me to Narcotics Anonymous. And I got the opportunity to grow. So my dad saw that I had a problem before I did, obviously, and he would drop off AA books at my doorstep of my apartment. And I would wake up in the evening and I would trip over these books. But I would bring them in, I'd put them on the coffee table, and I'd be like, Dad, thank you so much, but I don't have the problem you do, so thanks, but no thanks. But he kept doing it. And he never gave up on me. And one night I was doing coke off of my off of my coffee table. Remember, I put them on my those books on my coffee table, and I opened up one of those books and I started to read it, and that shit was about me, and I slammed that shit shut and put it back underneath there and did another line. But I kept picking up those books, and I was just done and I was tired, and I found NA. And oh my gosh, growing up with a parent in recovery, I'm so grateful because I went through things that he went through, and through me growing in recovery and working the steps of Narcotics Anonymous, I have so much compassion and empathy and sympathy for my dad that unless you're an addict, you wouldn't have. And like, I forgive my dad for emptying out my college fund and shoving it up his nose. And I asked him about it all the time because I was excited because, you know, back in the day when we got mail, I don't know how, if we have any young people in here, they used to send bank statements to your house printed in the mail. And my grandfather started a college fund for me and put lots and lots of money in it because he owned a successful grocery store chain. And that money was going to pay for me to go to college and, like, literally set me up for life. And my dad's name was also in the account. And the statement stopped. And I would say, Dad, where'd the statements go? He'd say, I don't know, ask your mother. Mom, where'd the statements go? I don't know, ask your father. Well, I got that back and forth for years. And then one day I was doing side work with my dad, and I was like, Dad, did you take the money out of the account? And we were painting, and he dropped the paintbrush, and he looked at me, and he started crying, and he said, yes. And I said, I'm not mad. I could absolutely go down the long road of like shoulda, coulda, woulda, he ruined my future, blah, 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 all that bullshit. No, everything happened the way that it was supposed to happen. I was brought to Narcotics Anonymous. I have had the privilege. You know, like in our literature, it says we are more fortunate to have this disease. And I think this last year is the first year that I truly believe that. Because this last year was made to break me. And let me rephrase, it was made to destroy me. And it may have broken off edges, but I fucking made it. The beginning of last year, a drunk driver struck a vehicle that I was driving with my 2-year-old in the car. And that opened up the door for a whirlwind of a year between the dealing with the dealership, dealing with the monetary stuff, the material stuff wasn't half the battle as like dealing with a concussion and all the things that come with a traumatic brain injury that I still deal with today. And I was able to show this man grace because he is no different than I am. The drunk driver that hit us, no different. Because I used to drive fucked up every day of my life. And I was covered by what I believe is to be the grace of God, that I never killed or hit anyone, that I never destroyed a vehicle. Like, it's wild. Like, I don't know. I just find irony in the fact that we were struck by a drunk driver the night of my home group after picking up my son, and I walked away from that accident. Do I have a traumatic brain injury? Yes. Am I getting through it? Yes. Is it fucking frustrating? Absolutely. However, no matter how much frustration or anger that I may have towards this person, I revert back to grace every single time. Like, growing up in this process has provided me the ability to show grace to a man that could have killed my child. Now, if he would have killed my child, I do not think that I would be up here having this conversation. I'd be in jail because I would have fucking killed him. Some shit you're saying spiritual, don't fuck with my kids. I'm sorry. I don't know that I'd be able to apply grace to that. However, my higher power is pretty damn powerful, and he probably would have showed me otherwise. But yeah, man, I mean, this program is so wonderful because we get to be whoever we want to be. We get to have whatever we want to have, whatever we're willing to work for. And growing up is a huge deal. I mean, when I got here, what was I, 26? 26, 27? 27 years old. And I was a broken little girl who thought that she had to use her body to get what she wanted, who thought that everyone wanted something from me, that nothing was free, that I wasn't worthy, that I wasn't enough. But this program has brought me through so many things. This program has taught me that I'm more than enough, that I'm more than worthy, that I don't have to use my body to get what I need, that I don't have to weaponize that ruthlessness that I used to be so great at doing. Without this program, I wouldn't have been able to grow into the woman that I am. I wouldn't have been able to have a marriage that I work on. I wouldn't be able to be the mother that I am, a willing participant as a parent, that wants to be a parent. Now, mind you, it is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, but I am so grateful because, like, when I was a little girl, when someone would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would say a mommy and a wife. I'm both of those things, but I'm not defined by just those roles either, which without this program, it would easily put me in that little box and I would be an unhappy human because stay-at-home mom life is just not cut out for me. Praise the ones that do it. Bless your soul, but I ain't it. I have a 3-year-old little terror that tests every defect I have. And I don't want to be the entire topic of him talking to his therapist one day, okay? I mean, I know I'm going to be in there because everybody's got fucking mommy issues and daddy issues. Sure. But I don't want to be the entirety of the issue. This program has had me grow to a point that I have a relationship with my mother, which I didn't think that I wanted or needed when I walked in these doors. She has actually grown through my recovery. A woman who would bulldoze through boundaries like it was a job that she was paid for. I swear to beans, if you know my mom, you know. She has learned to respect those boundaries. Does she toe the line? Abso-fucking-lutely. Absolutely. But I have grown to have love and compassion and learn how to say things in a loving and caring way and say, Mom, you need to pump the brakes and take a step back. And she'll push just a little bit more, and then I stand my ground. And then she respects it, and then she takes a step back. 10 years ago, fucking forget it. I knew nothing. She knew everything. I just need to do whatever she says because she knows everything. Our parents don't know everything. They do the best they can with what they have. This program has also taught me that. Because guess what? Nobody gave me a book when I left the hospital with my son. They gave me a baby and said, good luck. Oh, gosh. Literally, I birthed this kid. I have a C-section. Took no opiates. Okay, Tylenol and, what's the word? Ibuprofen. Thank you. Tylenol and ibuprofen only. And I'm trying to breastfeed this kid with a C-section scar at home. And I'm like, they don't send you help home? Like, there isn't a nurse that comes with us? Shit. But I used the tools that I had. I used the network that I have. And I was able to get through it. And, like, in hindsight, I'm like, maybe it was because I was so sleep-deprived. But in hindsight, I can't believe I made it through. Like, they sent me home with the oxys. I had an excuse to use them. And I didn't. I made a choice not to use them. Maybe I fucked up. Maybe I should have just done it. Just kidding, Spons. Oh, no, but I got to send them home with my mother, and I said, take them out of this house. It's been day 4. The doctor said if I'm not in enough pain at this point, that I wouldn't need them. I sent them home with her and didn't think about them again. Man, to be able to sit up here and share hope and growth with other addicts. You know, this program's about the newcomer, right? If you think about where you want to be in 5 years and the list is short, you're selling yourself short, right? I challenge you to write down what you want in the first year of your recovery, in the first month of your recovery. And I promise you, when you make it, not if, because you will, when you make it, I want you to look back and you're going to have achieved so much more than that. Because we all get a chance and a choice. And what are we going to do with it? If you've made it to this room, it wasn't by accident. I didn't make it here by accident. I mean, in the beginning, I thought I did. I was like, oh, we're just going to dry out for a little bit and go back. Nah. This program has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. I mean, I got to grow financially. I got to clean up my credit. I got to build credit. I got to go through the process of buying a home. I got to buy a brand new car. Has anyone bought a brand new car right off the lot? Isn't that such an incredible feeling? Nobody co-signed for me, but guess what? That drunk driver hit that car and took it. No, it is funny. It is. It's fucking funny.
Did you buy a new car?
No, I didn't. I bought a 2025 SUV after that. But guess what? We were able to do that. You know, like, that's crazy. Oh, my God, they're using me driving a brand new car. That's out of reach. Who does that? That's for rich people. No, it's for people who grow the fuck up and people that want things for themselves, and they work hard for them and do what's suggested and do the right thing for the right reason. You can have whatever you want. If you want to go to college and you want to get a PhD, do it. It starts with one class at a time. If you want to work for the government and do crazy shit and build aircrafts, fucking figure out how to do it. If you don't know how, start talking about it in meetings. People will get you to the right people. Narcotics Anonymous is all kinds of people. This disease does not discriminate. And everyone in any area could be an addict. You know what I mean? Like, just, oh, gosh. Don't sell yourself short. How much time do I have? 5 minutes-ish? Okay. Well, I'm going to start lying. Because I feel like, for whatever reason, I'm feeling like I need to shut it down. So in short, I want to say that my dad was an addict. Let me rephrase. My dad was a using addict. My dad is a recovering addict now. He planted the seed of this program. He never gave up on me. He always believed in me. I got here. I chose a different fellowship. I was able to walk on my own in this program, not in his shadow, not because he brought me here, not because he asked me to go, but because he planted a seed and believed in me. I have a relationship with my dad today that I would literally do anything for this man, okay? If you call me today, told me that some weird stuff had happened, I'd ask him where we're digging the hole, and I wouldn't bat an eyelash. I swear. 10 years ago, 12 years ago, my dad was not that great in my eyes. No, but I know what he went through. I know what he fights every day because I fight the same demon. And the bond that we have is something so special. I'm so grateful for this program. I'm so grateful for the growth that I have experienced. I can't wait to see, you know, where life takes us. Because I was also blessed to have a husband as a recovering addict. So as long as we keep showing up for one another, keeping God in the center of our marriage, God, recovery, each other, and everything else that... You know, we're kind of unstoppable. So, I'm Kate, and I'm an addict. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks.
Thank you, Kate. And I would like to introduce our second speaker, RJ.
You don't have to clap, it's okay. Tag name RJ.
Hi, RJ.
It's an honor and a privilege to be up here speaking today. I want to thank the committee for seeing something in me. It's taken me a long time to see myself, you know. And I've done some meetings on growing up in recovery, youth in recovery, all that good stuff. And I've been around long enough that I'm starting to make it to the old in recovery section. I still have a few years to go, but, you know, I'm getting there, which is, you know, a true testament to this program. You know, I grew up in the 90s. I was born in 88. And in the 90s, it was prevalent to have block parties. And for me, growing up, everybody was friends with everybody, and I never had a chance. You know what I mean? My mom was also a using addict. She's in another fellowship or was. So for me, like, my earliest memories are me sipping beer, drinking at, you know, house parties that we would have, eating crabs, doing all that good stuff, you know. So back then, recovery wasn't as mainstream, I guess, as what it is now. You know, it was still a little bit of taboo going on. So it just wasn't ever a problem. You know, like, nobody looked at it like that. The thing was is that as the party stopped, they never stopped for me, right? So I grew up and I got into a different neighborhood. And when I was introduced to this new neighborhood, I was introduced to older brothers that I had never known before. And those older brothers were participating in things that I had no idea what it was. But all I knew is I wanted to be a part of it, right? I always had this feeling that, like, I wanted to fit in. And whatever somebody else was doing, I wanted to be a part of it, whether it was good, bad, or indifferent. And, you know, that started me on a long road. I mean, I started using, and I related to grades. I don't really know ages. When I was in fifth grade, I started smoking cigarettes. Sixth grade, I started smoking weed. And it just kind of progressed from there. when I got out of high school, I barely passed by the skin of my teeth or whatever. And I never looked at college because I just wasn't built for college. You know, that wasn't in my future. Like, I never saw me doing that. And it's so funny. I was having this conversation with my sponsor the other day, is the math and everything I used to gripe about doing in high school, I use every single day of my life now in the field that I do. And I wish I would have paid attention a little bit more. But, you know, we're here. And, you know, so when I walked into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, it was after a failed suicide attempt. I was 21 years old. I had just turned 21. And I was in a really deep, dark place. And I didn't see a way out. Thank goodness that my mom was in another fellowship, and when I needed to call somebody, she was the one that I reached out to. However, my mom and I have a very tumultuous relationship as well. You know, there's so many things that we had struggled with growing up, you know, with her being in her midst of her addiction and everything, me becoming this up and growing addict and addict at the time. We were butting heads a lot, and, you know, my parents got divorced when I was in the fourth grade. So it was just me and my mom, and I'd see my dad every other weekend. So when my mom and I were together, I mean, we were just butting heads the whole time. But when it came time for me to, you know, surrender and to start going down this process of recovery, she was the one that I reached out to. And I worked for my dad at the time. I still work for my dad now. But I worked for my dad at the time, and I remember showing up to this job, right? I just tried to commit suicide. Somehow I fumbled into work. And I remember sitting in the back of the shop, right? It was a blue-collar shop. Everybody's carrying around big pipe wrenches, and I'm this little kid in the back of the shop at 21 years old crying because I had no idea how to live life. Like, that's where my addiction took me to. And at 21 years old, I look back at it, and I'm like, how much fucking life would I have given up, right? You think about a 21-year-old. You know, like, I'm 37 now, and if I could have just, like, had a conversation with myself, you know, you're talking about, like, don't sell yourself short and all that good stuff, and, like, you know, if I could have just talked to my 21-year-old self, what I would have said, how much I was throwing away and how much I was giving up, you know, and it's taken me time to get to that place, but at 21, that's where I was, you know, and I remember walking into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, and I walked into a meeting called Step Into the Light. It was my first meeting ever. It was a Northeast Freedom Area. It's still around to this day. Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. And I sat down in the back room and I looked at the floor and I couldn't look anybody in their eyes and I didn't want to either. And, you know, I remember when I was staring at the floor, these 2 feet came into my vision and I said, RJ, whatever you do, just don't fucking look up, dude. Right? But these feet wouldn't go away. They just stayed there. And I'm like, man, what is going on? So I slowly started finding myself looking up. Met this woman at her eyes. Her name was Dana G. Some people in this room might know her. She is nuttier than squirrel turds. She would back that up. It's nothing that, you know, I'm allowed to say that. Just don't tell her that, right? No, I'm just kidding. And she said, oh, baby, welcome. And she picked me up out of my chair, and she gave me the biggest hug that I'd ever gotten in my life. And it gives me chills thinking about it to this day because You know, I've read something on social media that says one day somebody's going to come along that's going to hug you so hard you're going to put all your broken pieces back together, right? And I'm not saying that Dana G put my broken pieces back together, but it was one hell of a start. And that was my introduction to my first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, right? And from that point on, like, you know, it has never, like, I haven't wanted to leave, you know? And when I walked into Narcotics Anonymous, I was 21 years old, and I had a secret. I was on a Suboxone maintenance program, and I didn't know anything about their traditions. And I remember sitting in the meeting, and there was a guy sharing, right? I'm not going to say who it was. I'm not going to break anonymity. I know you guys want me to, but I'm not going to. And he was sharing just some bullshit about taking Suboxone and everything else. And what it told me, because I was a newcomer at the time, was like, I'm just not going to talk about it. I'm just not going to say anything about it. I'm going to keep it a secret. You know, you guys just aren't going to know that part of me. I'll work the 12 steps. I'll get a sponsor. I'll do this stuff. But I just won't share this one part of my life. And the thing is like those secrets keep us sick, right? And luckily, I kept coming around. I didn't let that take me out of the rooms. And I kept coming around, and I kept listening to people share. And it got to a point in my life where I just couldn't be okay with the way that I was living, right? You know, recovery started to work without my permission. How many times have we heard that? And I remember sitting down in a meeting and just feeling this, like, rush coming over me. And I'm like, man, I just can't do this anymore. Like, I can't hold on to this secret anymore. And the thing was, it's like, I had worked steps while being on Suboxone. You know, we can call it a fraudulent step. I don't know if there's such a thing. People say it, but whatever. I think a stepped work is a stepped work. You gain the knowledge from it, or I did at least. And it put me to a place in my recovery where I was ready to take the next step. You know what I mean? Like, would I rather be on Suboxone, reading a basic text and a step work, or being staring down the loaded of a barrel of a loaded gun? You know what I mean? Thinking there's not another way out. I don't know about you guys, but I'd rather be reading the basic text, right? You know? And basically got to the point where I had, you know, celebrated a year clean. I said a whole bunch of good stuff in front of the meeting. Everybody clapped, and I felt really good about myself. But when that meeting was over, like, I had gotten this conscience, man, and I just wasn't okay with what I was doing. And I needed to do something different. So I still wasn't done with the lies. I told everybody I had went back out on this crazy relapse. And I couldn't just tell them, like, hey, I've been on Suboxone for the last 18 months. It had to be this crazy relapse, right? And the thing was, is like the people that I was introduced to when I first got Narcotics Anonymous paved the way for who I am today. They absolutely set the foundation, and they set the bar really high. The first home group that I was ever a part of, Step Into the Light, was a God-given home group, and I know that they all are. And I get, you know, it chokes me up thinking about it to this day because there were so many things that happened in that meeting that I got to experience that I don't think I'll ever see again, you know. And it's an amazing thing. And I was introduced to this guy named Floodsy P. And he became my sponsor. And I absolutely love this guy. And he would tell me things like, you know, he values his life by how many numbers he has in his phone and not how many commas he has in his bank account. He would show me, like, unconditional love. You know, and when he passed away with 25 years clean. And I got to be a part of the home group that put an infinity medallion in his casket. And I'll never forget being a part of that home group and standing around there, and we're all just talking. And, you know, Helene was leading our prayer and everybody put their hands on that medallion and got to put it in his casket. And, you know, that's real stuff, man. And, you know, I got to be a part of that. And that was like that's like what started to shape me as an addict in recovery. And it was those type of things. It was those people that I'd met that told me how to be a man, right? And, you know, my definition of a man has definitely changed since I've walked into the rooms in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I thought a man just did what he wanted to and, you know, went wherever he wanted to and everything. And, you know, now my understanding is that we handle our responsibilities, right? So I'd stayed in recovery. I told everybody about my secret. I had finally gotten, you know, off of everything. I came back and, you know, was hit the ground running. And this time I wanted to be the best recovering addict ever, right? I wanted to have statues erected in my honor, posters up on the wall of how good of a recovering addict I was. I wanted everybody to know that I worked six steps in 1 year. You know, it was unheard of, but I did it. You know, and then worked all 12 by 3 years, humble brag. And the thing was, is like, all that stuff was setting me up for a time in my life when I was going to need, when I needed to recall it the most, right? Because life shows up. And it doesn't matter how many years you have clean. It doesn't matter how many times you've worked the 12 steps in Narcotics Anonymous. It doesn't matter who your sponsor is. It matters about how much I've put into my recovery, my relationship with my higher power, and how much, like, I'm battling the disease, right? How many hits I'm putting on the disease. And, you know, I've been through a lot of things in recovery, and I haven't found any excuses to use because of them. And I've been very close, you know, and, like, you know, I've been gracious enough to be a father in recovery. So I got in here when I was 21. I finally had a kid when I was 34, 35. And, you know, it was a very crazy process. And I got with my wife, Lindsay, and when I met her, she had a hot... 47 days clean. And it was so funny because, remember, I told you I was like the best recovering addict, right? And like men sick with the men and women sick with the women, and I didn't participate in any of that. And there was just something about this girl I couldn't say no. And she came up to me, and the funniest part was, is I shared a meeting, and she said, "Man, I really got a lot out of what you shared, blah, 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 blah." And I said, "Men stick with the men and women stick with the women." And she said, "Okay, challenge accepted." But the funny thing was, is like, I wasn't ready for the challenge. I was really, really trying to like push her away. And then, and you know, dude, I'm not telling you about some girl I met in a meeting. I'm telling you about my wife. And, you know, it was a crazy, road, since we started dating and everything. And, it was funny. She was in a recovery house. I would pick her up, from the recovery house, and we'd go out to dinner, and then she'd say, "Okay, it's almost curfew." So then I'd hightail it back before she turned into a pumpkin, you know, and dude, like, life was just fun, you know what I mean? And then the time came when she relapsed, you know, and that wasn't fun, and that sucked. And the thing was, and this is the crazy part about recovery, is I had a roommate at the time, and I said, "Hey, man, my girlfriend just relapsed. Do you mind if she moves in with us?" Right? I mean, that's a great one, right? And he's like, "Fuck no, dude." He's like, "No, she's not moving in here. Are you kidding me? Like, I'm not inviting that insanity into this house." And I was like, "All right, I don't blame you." And I was telling my mom about the situation, and not even like talking, not even like going to my mom for anything, just telling her about the situation, right? And she says, "She can stay here." I said, "What?" I said, "I've been dating this girl for a hot, I don't know, it was like 4 months at the time. I guess that was long-term for me. And things were getting pretty serious, I guess you could say. Marriage was right around the corner." And, you know, and my mom was like, "You know, she could stay here if she wants." And I said, "All right, I'll ask her." You know, she'd never met my mom before. So I was like, "Hey, Mom, this is my girlfriend. She just relapsed. Thanks for letting her in the house. And it's getting pretty serious." Right? So she lived with my mom for a week, and it was an amazing process, right? And I remember going to Lindsay, and I said, "Look, this is your deal." She had gave me some money that she had from a tax return, and I said, "Listen, here's your options. I can give you this $1,500. You can find a hotel, or, you know, whatever you need to do. Hopefully when you come back, you know, we can pick this back up or whatever you want to do." I said, "Or you can stay with my mom," and she made this decision that she wanted to stay with my mom, right? And I remember when she made that decision, there was just like a little bit of hope that started, you know, firing up inside of me that, man, she might actually stay, you know, she might get it, you know, and that was freaking 10 years ago, just 10 years clean now, you know what I mean? It's amazing. So, you know, so we like grew up in that process, right? First love, first recovery love, all that good stuff. We had our own rehab romance just outside of rehab, right? And, you know, I remember when I proposed to her, like, we were down in Miami, and we actually got kicked out of another wedding. Long story. It wasn't as bad as it sounds. It was, but it's not. It's not, like, our fault. It was a mutual separation of this other couple. Anyway, that's a whole nother thing. And I remember we were down, and we were getting ready to go into this fancy restaurant. I said, "Let's take a walk on the beach." I remember I kneeled down. I asked her for a hand in marriage. She said yes. I, you know, somebody was walking by, took a picture. It was like a really good moment in my life. And then I stood up and I stepped in dog shit. I had to go to this really fancy 5-star restaurant with crap on my shoe. And then we went to pay for the meal that we had, right? And my card got declined because I didn't tell my credit card company that I was going out of state, and they thought it was like fraudulent or whatever. So, you know, anyway, that was just a funny story. Back to recovery, growing up in recovery. And basically what I'm saying is that there were so many things that I had done early in recovery that set the foundation for what was about to happen to us. And anybody that knows me knows my story and has heard me share about this. And I'll do the Campbell Soup version condensed. My wife and I struggled with infertility for years, for 3 or 4 years. And we tried every letter of the alphabet for treatment, IUI, you know, the whole nine yards. We had frozen eggs. We had done, you know, countless doctors. We had done everything. And every day or every time that we had tried to do these treatments and they didn't work, we were pulling away from ourselves one part at a time. You know what I mean? With one negative test at a time, I should say. And it happened so quickly, but also so softly, that we didn't really know what was going on, and recovery for us kind of ceased to exist, right? We had been going through this time in our lives that was, like, very, very tough. And it was years of this. And we were still going to our home groups, and we were sharing about it, and we were talking to people about it. It's not like we stopped showing up or anything like that. It's just something, like, a little piece of us was dying every time we got this negative test. And for me, like, I was always one of those guys that could take it or leave with, when it came to kids, you know? But for my wife, like, she really validated herself for you know, being able to be a woman and have a child and everything. And when it wasn't happening, I had to watch the person that I love go through pain every single time. And, you know, that starts to wear on you. You know, I thought because of me growing up in recovery that I had matured, right? Because when I think of growing up in recovery, it's not necessarily getting older. It's maturing in the way that I think and feel and how I respond and everything. But it's not until I'm put into these crazy situations that, like, I show my true colors and how I really am on the inside, you know? And through that experience, I learned that, like, I had a lot that I still needed to work on, right? And that's what I mean. Like, when I made the joke earlier about working 6 steps in a year, like, at the time, that felt like such a big achievement, but it didn't mean shit because in this very moment, I couldn't work them, right? When I needed them the most, when I needed to pull them out of the bag, when I needed to put character defects aside, show true, honest love and compassion, like, I just didn't have it inside me. And, you know, it's just because I was hurting too, you know? And it's, like, tough to use the tools that we have in the worst possible time. You know, you would think, like, oh, it's so easy to open up the toolbox when you need your freaking tools. But it just wasn't the case for me, and it wasn't the case for her. So you have these two addicts that are doing their best to try and stay in recovery, except we're being pulled apart every single time that we get one of these negative tests, and it was a really, really tough time. And then through a miracle, we were able to conceive, right? And it was an amazing day, and I remember it like it was yesterday, and seeing the joy on Lindsay's face and everything, and I'm like, man, we finally made it, right? But, you know, we were just getting started. And when we got it, it was in a height of COVID. You know, I had gotten COVID a couple times. I stayed home and remodeled the house when I had COVID. Well, Lindsay ended up getting COVID during her pregnancy, and it was really bad. And we ended up having to deliver Michaela at 26 weeks gestational. So she was very early. She weighed 2.5 pounds. And it was just a fury of different feelings and emotions. And I remember being in the hospital, I'm setting this up. I remember being in the hospital, and it was COVID, so nobody else was allowed there. It was just me and her and a bunch of anxious grandparents waiting by the phone for me to call and let them know that it was very successful or what was going on, because we were only there for a checkup, but because of how bad things were going, we had to deliver. When they delivered her, Lindsay went DIC and started bleeding out, and she almost died. And then Michaela was 2.5 pounds and was, you know, whisked away to the NICU. And I remember standing there in this hospital all by myself, and I was in a hallway, and above me was Michaela fighting for her life, and below me was Lindsay fighting for hers, and feeling ultimate powerlessness for the first time in my life. And I shouldn't say the first time in my life, because I have been powerless over active addiction. I know what it feels like to wake up every single day and every thought be driven by just getting one more. But there was something that happens when I was clean and I'd been working this program, and I remember standing in that hallway saying, I worked the fucking steps. Why is this happening to me? I did everything I was supposed to do. There was posters with my picture on it. There were statues with me, you know? Like, I did the best that I could in our Cox Nama, so put this motherfucker on my back, right? Why is this happening to me? And at the end of the day, why not me? You know what I mean? And I remember being in that hallway and just not knowing what to do and not where to go and not knowing anything, and I'll never forget this nurse was walking by me, and I just was breaking down. And you weren't supposed to touch people because it was COVID, and she just gave me this hug. She didn't even care. And she says, I'll tell you what, I know things are really bad for you right now, but let's go see that daughter of yours. And she pulled me out of this really rough time. And I went and saw my daughter, and I couldn't touch her. I couldn't. See you, buddy. This guy leaving right here. Don't leave. Don't leave. We're just getting to the good stuff. All right, man. See you, brother. I remember standing there looking at my daughter for, honestly, the first time, and she was in this isolate, and I couldn't touch her or anything, and just, like, feeling so lost. And I remember Lindsay pulled through. They called it the New Year's Eve miracle, and it was amazing. Like, she had this awesome recovery and everything and had gotten out of the hospital in 7 days, and she, too, had a C-section. And I just want to put on record here that for any woman that has given birth, C-section or any other way, I have the utmost respect for you because I was in that delivery room and I watched everything happen. And when it's an emergency C-section, they don't put the curtain all the way up. You just get this little knee-high curtain. And let's just say, like, I could see things of Lindsay that I should never have been able to see and, like, what they were moving around. And I'm just like, holy smokes, you know what I mean? And they're like, hey, man, you don't have to look at this. And I said, no, I do. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't look away. It was like a train wreck, you know? I was like, this is so bad, but I can't look away, right? And then when they lifted Mikhail up, I mean, it was a really cool process. But anyway, so she was, like, recovering from that, and she did take opiates, you know? She did take medicine. And that was, like, one of the hardest things was trying to get her to stop taking it, you know? And it's not that she was abusing it or anything like that. It's just one of those things, like, once you turn that, exactly what you're scared of, once you turn that thing on, it is so hard to turn off. And I remember being in the store, we were getting groceries, and it was the same grocery store that our pharmacy was at, and we were going up and down the aisle, and Lindsay would just turn her head and look at the pharmacy and then come back down the aisle. Then we come up, we go back down the other aisle, and she'd be looking at the pharmacy. And I told her, I said, babe, I think you're good enough now. I don't think you need those meds, and I think that you should go tell that pharmacist that you don't need them. And she said, tell the pharmacist I don't need these meds. And I said, yeah, I do. You know, like, we hold each other accountable in here, right? You know, it's recovery in action. We hold each other accountable around here. And I said, I think they're talking to you. You know what I mean? You're no longer taking them because you're in pain. You're taking them because you want to. Or you're going to start taking them because you want to. And she walked up to that pharmacist, and she had this scowl on her face, man. And she was telling, and the pharmacist was like, you don't want them. The pharmacist was like, you sure you want them? So, you know, and it was, like, amazing. Like, at that time, it wasn't amazing. But when I look back on it, like, that's how much we love each other. You know what I mean? Like, we're able to hold each other up through that time. And the thing was, is, like, I wish that I could say, like, once Mikhaila came home, she was in the NICU for 3 months. It was absolutely crazy. We were on this, like, rent-a-baby program or lease-a-baby because we could go there and see her, but then we had to give her back. Mikhaila was born for 2 months before Lindsay and I got to see her together because of COVID. It was just a really weird time. And you would think through being through all that, like, I'd love to be around them and to cherish every single moment I had with them. But the truth was, is I was suffering from PTSD, and I didn't know that. You know what I mean? Like, I had this undiagnosed PTSD, and, like, I thought that as a father, like, I just show up, right? And as long as I show up, everything's going to be okay. But, like, I was lacking in love. I was lacking in compassion. I was lacking in all these things that I learned in recovery, right? All these spiritual principles that I learned in recovery, and I had lost myself in work. And I said, if I just go to work and make money, because she was a stay-at-home mom at the time, and it didn't work out for us. She was not a good stay-at-home mom, and it was very bad for her health, for her to be a stay-at-home mom. And through all that, I got the 5 minutes, so I'm going to try and wrap this up pretty quick. Through all that, I remember going on a work trip, and I got home from this work trip, and things had gotten pretty bad. And I walk in the door, and she says, I can't do this anymore. And I said, you can't do what anymore? She says, this marriage, I'm leaving. And I was like, man. I was like, dude, like, you just almost died. Mikhaila just almost died. Like, I'm doing the best that I can to get. And, like, I couldn't see on the outside. I couldn't get outside of myself to see how miserable I had become. And she said something to me that rattled me to my core. She says, I didn't get clean to be this miserable. Mm-hmm. I went, oh, my God. I'm like, okay, at least you said it, right?
And just as I was that, showing that courage to tell her like she needs to stop taking that medication, she was showing me the courage that like we need to do something different with our lives. Like things are not going well. And basically where we were both were heading was we were going to use. You know what I mean? It was only a matter of time. And I had already almost used when Michaela, when Lindsay had her pain meds. And luckily I made out with that. And I remember standing at my counter with these pain meds in my hand, and I had 9.5 years clean, man. And I'm looking at these pain meds, and I had my phone sitting right here, and I had these pain meds in my hand. I was watching them for Lindsay. My sponsor at the time knew how many were in there because I'd call him and I'd say, hey, there's 9 in here today. Okay, Lindsay's going to take one at noon. There's going to be 8 in here. You know, like that's how much I had to break it down. And, but at that point in time, like I didn't care about the accountability. Like I just didn't want to feel. And I remember looking at these pain meds and I looked at my phone and I did the one thing that they tell us to from the first meeting that we get here, pick up the phone and not the drug. And I remember I called a sponsee and he happened to pick up and I said, dude, I want to use so fucking bad. And he said something so simple, but it was like exactly what he needed to hear. He says, you got a baby that's in that hospital that fucking needs her dad. And that put everything into perspective for me. You know what I mean? And it was one situation that I made it out with my clean time because, like, I turned to recovery. You know what I mean? It was me, my disease, and my recovery. And because I was feeding my recovery the way that I was able to pick up that phone and, like, get out of that situation. And then, you know, we're faced with this, like, divorce and everything that we're going to get ready to go through, the separation. And we were separated for a year. And in that year, instead of crying and trying to figure out all that I did wrong, you know, I said, I'm going to put a new foot down and I'm going to do what I was told in recovery, you know? And I started over. I started going back to the gym. I started going back to meetings. I started working my steps again. I remember I got Howard as a sponsor, not the name drop. He's right here in the front row. And, and I said, Howard, look, man, I got 10 years clean, pal. I'm not a needy sponsee. I share this all the time, too. I can't help it. I said, Howard, I'm not a needy sponsee. Don't expect me to call you every day. You know, I'm going to call you when I'm ready to go for some step work, that kind of thing. And then Lindsay leaves. I'm calling him every day. Dude, every freaking day, maybe multiple times a day. Howard, I can't do it, man. I don't know what I'm doing. And the thing was, is like, dude, because of the foundation that I had in recovery, because of growing up in this process, I was able to make the hard calls when I needed to make them the most. You know what I mean? That's why I'm sitting here telling you a victory story, not a defeat story. You know what I mean? That's why I'm sitting here with 13 years clean and not 0 years clean. It's because when rubber met the road, I was able to pick up my phone and I was able to do the things that we were told to in recovery. With that, I think that's all I got to share. Thanks for letting me share.